Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In addition to the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan, the Pentagon is wrestling with two major issues. First, a budget reduction from Congress of nearly $500 billion over the next 10 years, and as much as $500 billion more in reductions if the mandatory cuts from the debt ceiling agreement are implemented. The second is a strategic pivot that's underway away from Europe and the Middle East towards the Asia-Pacific region as a counterbalance to China's growing military. While the U.S.-Chinese relationship is more cooperative and peacefully competitive than antagonistic, both sides do have contingency plans for conflict. My guest today tells us how the Pentagon is dealing with both of these issues and offers a strategy that takes both funding and strategic planning into account. My guest is Colonel Thomas X. Hammes, a retired Marine Corps colonel who spent 30 years in the Corps, serving as a commander of a rifle company, a weapons company, an intelligence company, an infantry battalion, and as well as the Chemical Biological Incident Response Force. He participated in stabilization operations in both Somalia and Iraq and has trained insurgents in various locations. He's currently a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He's a highly respected military thinker, and he's an originator of the new strategy Offshore Control, which is a change in military doctrine towards China from more aggressive conflict to a blockade strategy. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week, and I spoke with him while he was here. Colonel Hammes, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's first talk about the defense cuts, which are looming at the Pentagon. The Obama administration originally was, I think it's around $450 billion, and now with this debt ceiling agreement, it's looking at another $500 to $600 billion of cuts, perhaps over the 10 years. What are those cuts going to have as far as impact on the military?
The problem, the first $450 billion was certainly manageable. The sequestration cuts, which will be the next $500 billion, if they don't reach a budget agreement, and it's unlikely in an election year that they'll be able to, those will be more difficult because they mandate where the cuts come from, and they have to come suddenly. Mm-hmm. And the way contracts are structured, et cetera, you end up cutting a lot more meat when you do it that way. And so those will be difficult to handle. That's an entirely separate issue as to whether the Pentagon's budget is sufficient or not. I'm one of those who believe it is sufficient and could actually settle in at about $500 billion a year without any damage to defense.
And still, is that still more spending than most of the rest of the world or the rest of the world combined?
The last report from IISS indicates that the U.S. Department of Defense budget is greater than the next 17 countries combined. We spend about 45% of the total global spending on defense is done by us. Mm. Of those next 17 countries, 11 of them are U.S. allies.
So our defense posture overall will still be good with these cuts. But let's talk about the 450, I think it's approximately $450 billion that was already sort of on the table. How will that impact the military?
Well, a lot of it, the problem is that instead of starting kind of with a clean sheet and saying, what do we need? And you would start that by saying, what are the potential threats out there? What would our potential responses be? Instead, we're starting from a position where we have programs. And this is one of the tricky things about the defense budget. In many congresspersons' eyes, it's the Department of Defense is a way to move tax dollars to selected congressional districts. The weapons companies figured this out. The big defense industry companies figured this out. The F-22 is made in over 400 congressional districts. The F-35 in over 400 congressional districts. The LCS is spread out. Your first problem in building weapon systems is to make sure it penetrates Congress so you can get funding. But the result is we get fairly inefficient weapon systems. The new LCS, the Littoral Combat Ship, which the Navy's building is supposed to be a lightweight, inexpensive combat ship, has gone from a $250 million price tag to $700 million. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include the weapons because they're not developed yet. And that's how ridiculous it is. The Danish Navy just commissioned three frigates. They could only build three because they're a small navy, so they've got the same problem with limited runs. They built them in Danish shipyards using Danish companies, and they paid $350 million and got some very, very capable warships complete with weapons.
And because we outsource a lot of the work across the country, Because everybody wants their sort of piece in the pie.
It's both outsourcing and then the people who design our weapon systems, instead of kind of staying with tried and true, they're always trying to way push the edge. One of the problems with the LCS is it was designed without weapons. The idea was there would be modules that would be put aboard the ship. One would be an anti-submarine module, an anti-mine warfare module, an anti-air warfare module, an anti-surface warfare. And depending upon the module you put on, the ship would be different. But, of course, this is totally experimental. Nobody's ever tried this before. We built two ships. The idea was the two different designs would compete. Whichever one won, we would then build 10. Instead, the two designs competed. Neither did well, so we decided to build 10 of each. It's that kind of decision-making process that's killing us in our defense budget.
And because Congress has a vested interest in keeping jobs in the various districts, what ends up taking the brunt of the cuts? Is it personnel?
Well, personnel will take a fair amount up front, but then that's the cuts we're contemplating now to get down the first $450 billion will still leave the Army and the Marine Corps significantly larger than they were on September 11th. Mm-hmm. Even if we have to cut additionally to get the $500 billion, they'll still be about the same size. So again, we're not sizing our forces against a specific threat, because what was the threat that required a military force that large on 9/11? In fact, the Bush administration, in a period of record budget surpluses, was looking hard at cutting both the Army and the Marine Corps further because you couldn't justify the forces. The original buy was 2,400 of the F-35 fighters. Seems a little more than we might need.
Right. Is there any effort to sort of create a strategy-first scenario for planning for military expenditures?
The Obama administration has been trying to do that. The problem, again, as you mentioned, is it gets tied up very much into Congress and congressional prerogatives in terms of what you spend your money on. That ties up what you can and what you can't do and how fast you can do it. So, yeah, the Obama administration is trying to develop that. That is part of the whole concept of rebalancing toward Asia. We've also still got one active conflict going on, and we've got to make sure we continue to fund that and work our way through those implications. And, of course, that's all part of that discussion. Do we bring the troops home at the beginning of the next fighting season or the end of the next fighting season? How big a force is there after 2014? What is it composed of? So, therefore, what will we have to rotate through? All those decisions are still in the air, so it's tough to make a normative military to say this is what we need.
You know, you talk about this pivot towards Asia. Certainly, during the Cold War, Asia was secondary, but there was the Seventh Fleet at that point in Asia. Why now is the time for the pivot towards Asia?
Well, I think, like a lot of people have said, is it's really not a pivot. It's a bit of a rebalance. We've never left Asia. The Seventh Fleet was always out there. We've kept troops in Korea. We drew down the troops in Korea, but then the Korean armed forces have been getting smaller. So it wouldn't make any sense for us to stay full strength if the Koreans don't think the threat is there. Mm-hmm. So we've been there. What it is an understanding that the next century, most of the economic growth will come out of the Indo-Pacific region, the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean, and therefore we should have more presence and more involvement there.
Where would that involvement come from? Because, you know, bases in Japan are somewhat controversial, have been over the years, Okinawa and the like. Philippines, we've had to close those bases. Where does this sort of expanded presence come from?
Well, now, of course, we've got Guam out there, which belongs to us, so we have a base there. The bases in Japan, really, it's a dispute over one air station in Okinawa. Mm-hmm. And the Okinawans, this is more an internal Japanese politics problems. And in Okinawa is a very small percentage of Japan's population and landmass, but they have about 70% of the U.S. military presence on their island. Because, again, we kept it after World War II, and that's where we built our bases. So it's kind of a history that led up. As we work through that, and what do we do with those forces? Do we draw them down? Do we pull them out? Again, for all the noise, Japan has been a long-term supporter. They pay a tremendous amount of the cost of our troops in Japan. Japan has also built a first-class Navy and Air Force for their own defense and are a treaty ally. Korea still has bases. They've encouraged training areas, ranges there. The Philippines have invited us back to training areas and ranges, no permanent bases yet, but constant training. We've just established a facility in Australia to take Marine units through company-level units to start increasing to MEU-sized units over time. This is at the same time the Australian Army is developing an amphibious capability so that there'll be a natural relationship there between the U.S. Marine station in Australia and the Australian Army regiment that's going to do their amphibious operation.
So getting back to the strategy, right now this is fairly peaceful area, mm-hmm. but the concern is because so much economic growth and economic necessity to the United States comes to this area, we should be there. Is that the philosophy?
We should have more presence. Again, because we've been consumed by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was a perception we weren't paying attention to Asia. I think the administration rightly wanted to reassure our allies in Asia that, no, we never left, and we have been paying attention. And now that we're out of Iraq and we're drawing down in Afghanistan, there'll be more attention to pay to that area.
China is paying more attention to its Navy and Air Force, correct?
Yes.
How much attention?
Well, China's got an enormous problem, what the Chinese strategists refer to as the Malacca Dilemma. China is totally dependent, its economy, on seaborne trade, energy for imports, and, of course, they're an export-driven economy. A lot of that trade goes to Europe, and, of course, because of the geography, if you look at what they call the first island chain, which is a line running down from Japan across to Taiwan through the Philippines, down and hooking up and ending at the Straits of Malacca. Essentially, that's South China Sea, East China Sea, and they are blocked into that. There are no friendly nations to China. There are no allies, and they're blocked in that area. So their entire economy is at the mercy of foreign navies. Just like the U.S. as a rising power began to build a navy to protect trade around the world, China feels obligated to do the same thing. The good news for the United States is the strategic geography favors us so heavily. It would be such a massive project, a decades-long project for China to build what it would be called a sea control navy, one of that allows you to use the sea. The United States has a sea control navy, but we also have sea denial capability. It's like what the Germans did in World War II was deny the use of the sea. Frankly, the way we crippled Japan in World War II was a submarine campaign. So while China has to spend a huge amount to develop that capability, Japan, the United States, Australia, Korea, all can use sea denial, which is much less expensive and geographically well-positioned to do.
So how much should we really fear from this? Because what you're saying is that China is building this up as a reaction to the idea that they aren't the master of their economic lifelines.
Well, I mean, China and the United States have a great deal in common. We're both trading nations. We're both linked into the world economy. It's not like when we faced the Soviet Union, which was
had ideologies. Yeah, ideologies.
Had an ideology, and it had a self-contained economy behind the Iron Curtain. China trades in the world. It desperately needs to be able to trade in the world. If it can't, then there's real problems for legitimacy of the Communist Party. A lot of people in Washington, particularly the right wing, will point toward China's growth in defense industry. Remember, they still spend less than 25% of what we do. And in addition, they spend more on internal security than on defense. While people point to a 12% rise in China's defense spending last year, they had a 13.5% rise in internal security spending. Frankly, China is much more concerned about their internal security than external security. While everybody points to the 12% rise in Chinese defense spending this year, it was a 13.5% rise in their internal security spending. So they are actually more concerned about internal instability than about us.
So what is the focus of U.S. strategy at this point? What are our strategic benchmarks or assets that we want to make sure that China has no way of interdicting?
Well, this is the grand strategy. The rebalancing to Asia would be economic, political, and military. We're beginning to develop the economic and political. Obviously, the biggest economic problem is our debt. Mm-hmm. And deficit. That's, in my opinion, the bigger threat, and then the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a bigger threat than anything else. The political shift we're seeing now as we begin to reassure allies, make firm it up. And the Chinese, frankly, the last 2 years were acting rather aggressively and therefore drove some of those people toward us because they fear Chinese hegemony. The piece that's missing is any military strategy. There is no openly discussed U.S. military strategy for China.
Mm-hmm.
We have an operational concept called air-sea battle. And this is in response to the Chinese in an effort, really in a response to the last Taiwan Straits crisis where we steamed two carriers right off China and there was nothing they could do about it. They invested heavily in what's called an anti-access aerial denial system. These are long-range cruise missiles. They're working on a anti-ship ballistic missile that literally enters space and then attacks the carrier from space, things like that. Essentially, they intend to push American forces back from their shores. So we have started, the Air Force and Navy put together initially a program, which is now a joint program with all the services, for called Air-Sea Battle. And the idea is to develop the Air Force and the Navy techniques so they could penetrate that anti-access aerial denial. The problem is, while it's an operational concept, it's not tied to any strategy. It will be an expensive operational concept. We'll have to invest a lot to be able to do this because defense is easier than offense, and they're defending in that role. So I propose, rather than trying to penetrate China and bomb Chinese mainland, which keep in mind they have thermonuclear weapons which they can deliver to the United States, we should take an offshore control posture, which is use an economic strangulation approach. The idea of fighting a war with China and having a decisive victory is a bad idea when they're nuclear armed. Better, what you're looking for is a resolution of the conflict as quickly as possible with as little damage to both nations as possible.
Uh-huh. And so this is basically what you're talking about is sort of a blockade.
It is. It's a combination of essentially there would be three tiers. Inside the first island chain would be a maritime exclusion zone. We would declare this an international law. We could then sink ships. Now, again, this assumes China starts the conflict. I don't see us starting a conflict. We would then help defend those nations on the first island chain, but without asking them to let us use their bases to strike into China. And then finally, by interdicting trade at the Straits of Malacca, Sunda Straits, Lombok Strait, north and south of Australia, we can essentially cut off that half of the globe from trade to China. We can do the same by holding the Panama Canal Zone, our west coast ports, and the Straits of Magellan.
So much of our relationship is cooperative in nature between U.S. and China. What does this say that, you know, journals are talking about ways in which we basically go to war with China? I assume the Chinese military are doing the same thing towards us.
Well, certainly, because, I mean, militaries are supposed to think about bad things that happen. That's our job. We plan for the worst things that happen. The scenarios we normally talk about when talking about conflict with China is something happening with the Taiwans over Taiwan. That would probably be only if the Taiwanese stood up and declared themselves independent. China is very patient. Going back to Mao, Mao said, look, it doesn't matter whether it happens in 10 years, 20 years, 100 years, we'll get there. Mm-hmm. And it probably won't be violent, but it will be if it needs to be. But they're very patient on this. If a Taiwan government makes that choice, then I'm not sure the United States government is any longer. I certainly don't feel obligated to protect 20 million Chinese who decide, in essence, to declare war on 1.5 billion other Chinese.
Mm.
So the only thing that would happen would be some reason China tries to take Taiwan Straits. The other place and much more likely scenario now is South China Sea. The famous nine-dashed line map, as opposed to the international UN Law of the Sea Treaty, possible claims, and then various territorial claims interacting with that really make the South China Sea a very, very complex arena.
Well, it is, but you know, when I think of the South China Sea, I sort of think of the way Americans think of the Gulf of Mexico. Is it a different issue?
Yeah, to a certain degree, because we don't claim all of the energy resources in the Gulf of Mexico.
Across
we don't
the whole,
say that we can ban anybody else from fishing in there.
And really, China,
and that's what China's seeking.
They sort of think of it as a lake rather than a sea.
No. But this is interesting because while they make some noises like that, they are actually doing cooperative exploration for energy. The key aspects there is there's tremendous potential energy resources there, none confirmed in large numbers, but potential. there's also the fish protein that China needs to feed its population. So those are areas which can either be areas of confrontation or areas of cooperation. And that's what we need to work is the diplomatic levers to try to make that an area of cooperation.
Do they tend to cooperate more than be conflicted at this point? Or are they beginning to assert more rights than...
Again, China's not monolithic. And this is one of the problems we have is people think China is one big thing like it was under Mao. When Mao said do this, it pretty much happened or he started something really strange again like a youth, the Red Revolution again. Now there seem to be separate power centers. I'm not a China expert, but it seems that sometimes certain parts of the government don't know what other parts of the government are doing. And, of course, we're certainly familiar with that problem here in the United States. And so there have been, after 2 years of confrontation, they realized they were stirring up the ASEAN resistance antibodies, and they've started to temper some of their statements and started to look for cooperation. And that's why I think any strategy on China, military strategy, rather than going at strike and confrontation, which accelerates and escalates a confrontation, back off and give it time to develop. Give us time, the negotiators time to work.
Mm-hmm. My guest today is retired Marine Corps Colonel Thomas Hammes. He is a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He's author, one of the authors of this new strategy towards China called Offshore Control, which basically looks at a blockade scenario in the case of ever conflict between the U.S. and China. The one thing you point out, it says, this would be our worst day ever if we actually had a conflict with China. We have so many relationships that we depend on each other for, trade, economic relationship, that this would just be a bad day for the whole world.
Well, this is, I mean, one of the points is if the United States and China ever have a serious conflict, we are in global recession or global depression almost instantaneously. Mm-hmm. It would be such a knock on the global economy. And this is one of the other cautions. When you hear people talking about this, ask them how their scenario ends. How does the war end and how long does it take? You've got to assume any war between continental-sized powers is going to be years long. This isn't going to be weeks or months. It will be years. So your strategy then has to accept that. And how do you rebuild an economy over that period of years? If your strategy can present China with a position where, because of the blockade, she can't rebuild her economy. The Silk Road is a nice dream, but we all know, particularly here in the middle of the country, what the cost of land haul is.
Yeah.
We, on the other hand, by holding the confinement just to that inside the First Island Chain, can rebuild a global trading economy outside the First Island Chain. And so we can start getting better while they are confronted with a worsening situation. That's how you get to resolution of conflict. Say, look, we haven't bombed you. Let's come to the table. We'll work this out. We can go back to trading.
Mm. Let's talk about the cooperation between China and the U.S. and certainly the competition between China and the U.S. But what about the areas where we, if not are in conflict, that we are testing one another? And I'm thinking of especially in cyber arenas, and maybe space as well. I mean, most average Americans are not privileged to what's actually happening in space, but certainly any IT professional can tell you that there are probes to internet security that a lot of times always say it's the Chinese.
It's not just probes. They have taken terabytes of data out of our companies and out of our government. That falls really under the category of espionage and industrial espionage. They are not wartime acts. We conduct espionage. Nations do that against each other all the time. And it certainly was a target of opportunity, and they took it. What's been interesting is despite all the stuff they've stole, they still don't have an economy that can capitalize on that tremendous knowledge they've stolen and produce products. We're not seeing products come out that we should be seeing if they were good enough to turn this intellectual capital into product. They're better at imitation and improving, great strides in improving in what we do. So we're beginning to understand that cyber piece, and we're beginning to compete in it. That would be very, very different than a cyber attack. Cyber espionage where exploitation is very different than cyber attack. An attack would be attempts to take down power systems, et cetera. How complex that is, I don't really know. It's obviously a dark arts type thing, and there's great disagreement even among civilians who work the project, what could and couldn't be done. Probably the most interesting thing for me about both cyber and space is they're both arenas that are offense dominated. If you go first, you gain a tremendous advantage. And this is another reason that the concept of air-sea battle or offensive operations against China worries me, because they would rely very heavily on space and cyber. So as you begin to get a confrontation, when you want to be slowing things down and talking, the problem is the advisor on the other side says, no, if we're going to execute the plan we have, we got to go now. Or if Americans are going to do this air-sea battle to us, they'll have to have cyber and space. But if we move first, we can get them. Well, you don't want the two militaries both wanting to be moving first. You want to put yourself in a position where you can move second and still not be crippled.
That's sort of cold. That goes back to the Cold War of your first strike.
Well, yeah, this goes back to before mutually assured destruction, during the really shaky period of the early atomic era, when both sides thought they could wipe out the other side's nuclear capability with the first strike, was a very, very difficult period.
Do you think that's entering into the strategic thinking of either side?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not privy to the discussions on cyber and space. Those are compartmented information, and unless you have a real need to know, you're one of the actual planners, they don't want you in it.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to me that from the open literature, it certainly is occurring to people in the United States. And this, again, is one of the arguments I'm making against an offensive-oriented, is because it's escalatory. And one of the key escalatory pieces is you got to move first or you're crippled in cyber and space. And if you're crippled in cyber and space, you can't really execute an offensive strategy. You cannot execute a blockade even without cyber and space.
And getting back to the beginning of our discussion, can you still execute that even at the budget cuts that we're likely to see in the military over the next few years?
Yeah, I think this again gets to allocation of resources. Now, one of the good news things is we're having a heck of a problem building ships and planes. Let's face it, you're reading constantly about the cost overruns on F-22, F-35, MV-22. We've had to cancel ground systems, carriers. But the nuclear submarines, the Virginia-class submarines, are coming in ahead of schedule and under budget. Now, that's pretty much unheard of for a Pentagon project. But the good news is that means that the precise weapons system we need most for this is available. We can produce them, and we can produce them relatively cheaply compared to other options. So if we reprogram spending to this standoff and denial campaign, we would get a different and somewhat cheaper military. The other advantage is we can actually execute this today. We have the resources to do this today. Penetrating into China in enough force to render them to the point they think they're helpless and have to give up, I don't know how you get to that point.
I think it's crazy to think about myself. It's a big country.
Yeah.
Anyway, Colonel Hamas, you'll be the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. He is a research fellow at the Institute for the National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. It's always good to talk to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good to see you again.
Colonel Thomas X. Hamas, a retired Marine Corps colonel who is currently the Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations earlier this week. Let's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.